You're listening to Midnight Harmony and our film story series. Because it is Valentine's Day and, in fact, my birthday, I thought, what could be better than sharing with you a love story? I hope you'll take a moment to curl up with someone, perhaps your children, and listen to our film story series as we begin this evening with Love Works. The story of a ballerina who uses her movements to teach and retrain the physically handicapped. But when an accident victim arrives in her studio and begins to impact the other clients, questions arise regarding the mysterious man and the haunting truth of his own past. Love Works is a part of our film series screenplay collection, and therefore may sound a little different in the telling because the story is made for film and therefore is told in a visual first-person narrative. Take just a moment and get yourself ready for our story, Love Works. Fade in. Once upon a time, on a moonlit night, a lone steed carried a figure across the frozen Russian landscape. Crystal snow burst from the steed's hooves as it galloped over the hilltops, across the frozen lakes, and into a deep forest. The horse comes to a sharp halt, its breath visible in the freezing air. The rider, still hidden beneath a black cape, spurs him on. Icicles hanging like lanterns from the immense trees, reflecting the moonlight, brightened the traveler's pathway. Suddenly, and without warning, a highwayman burst from the trees. The highwayman, tall yet slightly hunched, leaned against a crude cane. His dress was obvious 18th century Russian military. Lunging forward, he grabs the reins of the horse and brings it to a standstill. The highwayman had a very dark countenance as he glared at the rider. He had deserted the war, and having known only death and heartache for so many long years, his face was disfigured into a horrible frown. The highwayman motioned for the rider to dismount. The rider does. There was a moment's pause before the rider looks up at the frightful robber, but when it does, we realize it is a beautiful woman. Intending to rob the rider, the highwayman now stared at the woman. Then, noticing a pair of ballet slippers hanging from the saddle of her steed, he commanded her to remove her cape, put on her slippers, and dance. The woman drops her cape, revealing a shapely and stunning figure. Tenderly balanced, she slips on her ballet shoes. She did as he commanded. The highwayman stared breathlessly at the ballerina before him. He had never seen anything so beautiful in all his life. Dropping the crude pack from his back, he pulled forth a warm, thick panther skin and laid it out on the ground. He bowed low as the ballerina stepped onto the skin. and then he watched in awe as the ballerina began to dance. The woman dances a delicate, fanciful dance. She danced more graceful than ever before. You see, she was a famous ballerina, but this was to be her most prized performance. The moon and the stars, the trees and the animals paused to watch. The icicles reflected her movements throughout the entire forest. The woman ended her dance. The highwayman, beaten and tired and lonely, lies back against the snowbank. The ballerina kneels at his side. Intending to have harmed the ballerina, the highwayman began to cry as he laid back in the snow. The ballerina knelt at his side and wiped away his tears with her hand. They stared at one another, the ballerina and the soldier. He asked her for a drink, but she had none. Reaching forth, the ballerina broke an icicle from a nearby tree. As the icicle was pulled from the tree, numerous others fell sharply yet gracefully to the ground in slow motion. Pressing the icicle to the soldier's lips, he drank from its cool moisture. The highwayman stared at the ballerina a long while. He was dying. A tear escaped her eye and ran down her cheek. The ballerina cried for the soldier and his sorrow. Then, giving her the only thing he had left to give, he passed away. Having covered him with the panther skin on which she had performed her greatest performance, she mounted her steed and rode deeper into the forest, in her hand the icicle that had touched her companion's lips. The horse and rider grew smaller as they moved into the forest. The legend says that upon her return to home, she placed the icicle into her music box beside her jewels, and to this day, it has never melted away. Interior department store, current day. The woman clerk, we'll call her Bonnie, behind the counter frowns as she impatiently waits for the electronic card reader to process billing information. Glancing up, she glares at the line of Christmas shoppers before her. Cindy, our customer, 26, long blonde hair, knockout lips, deep blue eyes, notices the clerk's frustration. "It helps if you smile," Cindy said. Bonnie was surprised. She looks up and stared at Cindy blankly. "What?" "I'm a bank clerk. I know what it's like to have everyone waiting for you, and you're just trying to do your job the best you can." Bonnie barely smiles. "Cindy, see that man over there?" Glancing to the end of the counter, the two women stare at a tall, handsome man in his mid-40s dressed in suit, waiting impatiently for someone. His drawn face further contorts when he stares at his watch. "Cindy, I bet deep down he's really a nice guy. I bet he's got a heart of gold." Suddenly the man looks up. Cindy smiles. Bonnie hesitates, but noticing Cindy, follows suit. She smiles as best she can. The man stares. He's not humored, and he doesn't smile. He shrugs as though he were asking, "What's taking you so long?" Bonnie: "And you were saying?" Cindy: "It doesn't always work. He's my fiancé. He never smiles. He's the only person it's never worked on." Bonnie grins. She smiles. The card reader spits out a receipt. Cindy signs it and gathers her purchases. "Thanks, Bonnie." Bonnie says, "How did you know my name?" Cindy motions to the name tag on her apron. Moving her purchase to one hand, she extends the other, introducing, "I'm Cindy, and you have a million-dollar smile." Bonnie shakes her hand. Cindy winks, then walks away. Bonnie smiles boldly. "May I help you?" Cindy approaches the man in the suit, Jackson Cole, 43, dignified, obvious by his well-pressed attire, rich, obvious by his distaste for the Santa begging for money just a few steps away. "Cole, what took you so long?" Cindy: "I wanted the perfect gift for the man I love." Revealing a handsome tie, Sidney holds it up to his breast. "Do you think he'll like it?" Cole: "Only if he doesn't give a damn about being late for his client." Grasping Cindy's arm, Cole ushers her past the Santa. "Merry Christmas!" Cindy: "Merry Christmas!" to Cole. aren't you going to give him anything? Ushering her out the door. I was about to, then I realized someone spent all my money on a stupid tie. Outside the department store, a second later, Cindy pulls away from Cole. She stares him boldly down. If you don't like it, I can return it and buy you something more useful. A guillotine, perhaps. Cole hesitates before offering. A guillotine would be more useful on a day like today, but I can use the tie to hang myself when my client calls me on the phone to tell me they went with another broker who wasn't late for his meeting. I like the tie. Impatiently checking his watch. Like the tie. Hate Christmas. Love you. Can we go now? Cindy is slow in offering a smile, but when she does, it radiates. She falls into his arms as he pulls her towards the street, where a very fancy, polished Porsche sits at the curb. Cindy, reaching into his coat pocket, quickly retrieves the keys and runs around to the driver's side of the car, giddy as ever. Let's go see my sister. She's not far from here. Cole follows her around the car into the busy street, but Cindy is quick and works her way back around to the sidewalk. Cole stands at the driver's side, Cindy at the passenger's. Cole, give me the keys. You've got to meet my family eventually, and they're going to love you. Cole, give me the keys. Cindy, okay. Family visits out. How about Paris? Cole, Cindy, give me the keys. Cindy, no, we can't drive to Paris. How about San Francisco? Cole, I'm going to be late. Cindy, teasing, I love San Francisco. Give me the goddamn keys, Cole says. Cindy stops. Her smile fades. Cole glares at her expectantly. Cindy tosses the keys across the rooftop of the car. Not on the roof. Cole catches them. He stares from the scratched roof to Cindy. He unlocks the car with a press of his hand. Beep. Get in. Climbing in himself, he waits for Cindy. Climbing in, Cindy slams her door. Cole waits out the silence as Cindy stares out her window. She doesn't look at him when she speaks. I love you, Jackson. You know I do. But you're going to have to apologize for that before I go anywhere with you again. She does not turn to look at Cole. He almost speaks, but then doesn't. With obvious frustration, he forces the keys into the ignition, starts the car, grinds the transmission into gear as we cut to the street just a moment later. The car whips into traffic and moves a dozen yards down the street like lightning. The light at the corner is yellow as Cole pulls into the intersection. Without warning, a fast-moving transit bus slams into the passenger side of the Porsche, forcing it across the intersection and pins it against a telephone pole. Bystanders scream. No one in the car moves. The accident debris comes to a final stop. The silence is deafening. Exterior Auditorium Ballet Company, 6 months later. A beautiful performing arts center on the corner of this busy street is enhanced by an adjacent park. All the leaves on the trees are in full bloom. Interior Auditorium Ballet Company. The only thing visible to us are shadows of a ballerina on the hardwood stage floor. Floodlights blind an occasional glimpse of this beauty, but the shadows of her movement captivate us as an instrumental melody fills our senses. The music fades. Our ballerina dissolves into darkness. A pause, and the auditorium lights along with stage lights fill the auditorium, revealing a single ballerina on stage. Suddenly, activity bursts forth as crew members fill the stage along with other cast members. The director, Jimmy Grigio, seated in the front row, claps while offering thoughts. Beautiful, Addie. I don't think we can improve on that much. Several troupe members sitting with Jimmy agree. Lindsay, heavy but graceful, Jacques, French, not distinguished, and Joey, a knife fighter from the Bronx with a knockout build and very baby face. Lindsay, it was perfect. Jacques, it was incredible. Joey, it was delicious. Everyone stares at Joey. On stage, Addie Gold steps from the shadows. Addie, delicious. I like that. Addie, 27, long brunette hair, shapely, captivates us with her long stare and pursed, perhaps sensuous, smile. A crew member hands Addie a towel. She gently dabs the sweat from her lips and cheeks. Jimmy stands and moves towards the stage, but not before questioning Joey. Delicious? You're watching the technique, not the girl. Off to the side, we now notice another individual. Michael Moon, about 35, as casual in spirit as he is in dress, jeans, t-shirt, worn tennis shoes. He steps to the front of the stage, wiping paint off his hands. He kneels at the front of the stage, glaring at Joey. Michael, keep your eyes off my girl, Joey. Joey grins sheepishly, exchanging a grin with Addie. Jimmy leaps onto stage and approaches Addie. The two talk quietly, discussing the dance. The other dancers prod Joey. Jacques, delicious and yummy. Waitress, I'd like to order dessert, but what I want isn't on the menu. Lindsay, a French accent. May I suggest the dancing desire? It's very smooth. Jacques, I think I'll have two. Lindsay, oh no, you won't be disappointed. It's delicious. Jackie stands and draws her hand down her slim figure. Jimmy is distracted with all the bantering as he tries to concentrate on the act with Addie. Addie, on the other hand, is having a hard time concentrating as she begins to giggle. Jacques, it melts in your mouth, not in your hands. Jimmy, hey! Everyone turns abruptly and stares at Jimmy. You're up next. Cut the crap and get ready. The group leaps from their seats and then clamber onto stage. Addie tries to focus as Lindsay and Jacques saunter by with grins. Joey, embarrassed, avoids her stare. Addie. Joey, what time is it? Joey looks at his wristwatch. 12 sharp, Miss Gold. Addie, to Jimmy. I have to go. Jimmy hands off several papers. Don't forget the changes in the second act. We're live in 2 weeks. Addie, correcting. Jimmy, it's live in 2 weeks. We're alive right now. Addie steps aside and places a tender kiss onto Joey's cheek. He is surprised. Addie turns to Michael as she licks her lips. Addie, delicious. Michael is not humored. Joey is all grins and can't believe it. Jacques shoves Lindsay, who offers a snarling smirk. Addie leaps off stage and grabs a jacket and several belongings off a chair in the front row. Michael steps to the front of the stage. Call me later, Addie. Bye. Crew and cast members in unison. Bye, Addie. Addie walks up the aisle and out the back door. Michael watches her go before turning. There are three stooges leaning against one another, tease as though they were kissing him and loving him up. Michael grins. Jimmy, however, is not humored. His words only cause more bantering. I can replace all of you. There are 500,000 dancers in the city looking for work, and all more talented than you three. This gets a rise from the three as they argue that fact among themselves. Michael quickly immerses himself back into his work, where he puts the finishing touches on a backdrop, which just happens to be the scene of a dark forest with glittering icicles. Exterior street, New York City, day. Addie, exiting the theater, takes in the cool, fresh air of this busy street. She offers a greeting to the millions of passerbys. Good morning, New York. She turns and walks briskly down the sidewalk. Interior Therapy Clinic, day. The activity of personnel surrounding us is like an emergency room, but the semblance is that of a nursery, gentle faces and motions as they interact with their clients. The clients respond to the kindness with patience and humility. The group of invalids is unique. Harry, an elderly man recovering from an amputation to his right arm. Kit, a mother with horrid burns and facial disfigurement. Billy, 30, a one-legged war veteran. Moses, a funny round-faced black kid in an upper body cast. He teases and plays with Kit's children, Becca, 12, and David, 7. It's an odd bunch. Our attention is suddenly caught by one other patient who sits in the corner alone. Sunshine from the window illuminates her stunning beauty. We only see the side of her face, which is slightly hidden from the golden hair which falls across her cheek. A smile, too, is evident as she remains intent on painting something on the table in front of her. A nurse summons her. Jessica, it's time to join the others. Jessica turns to face us. Her beauty is unique, but it is quickly evident that she has Down syndrome. It is only evident slightly and is not distracting from her sparkling eyes and brilliant smile, yet obvious that accounts for much of her inability to move gracefully. Her arms are tightly clasped against her abdomen, and she walks with a slight drag of her left foot. The group of patients assemble into a circle. All this has been viewed from the point of view of one other character, Jackson Cole. He is not the dignified, brave man we remember from the opening scene, for now his face is disturbingly contorted. His eyes are half shut, deep, almost dead. His whole head turns in an effort to see things. His arms are crumpled in his lap, and his legs obviously disfigured as he stares at the others from the wheelchair where he sits in the corner of the room. A nurse, Becky, drops her face into our startling Cole. She refers to a clipboard so as to get the name right. "All right, Mr. Smith, it's a beautiful day. Are you ready to join the others?" "Mr. Smith?" We're certain it's Cole, but the name change surprises us. Cole disapproves. His words are spoken with difficulty and oftentimes delivered with a great guttural groan. "No." Becky pushes Cole toward the group. "Know what? It's not a beautiful day, or you don't want to join the others?" She stops the chair next to a table near the circle where everyone else sits anxiously. And crouching to his level, Becky offers, "Too bad you don't have a choice. You're already here, and it is a beautiful day." She smiles brightly. Cole avoids the stares, but really, no one is staring, only looking from one to another. The room is small. Therapy equipment fills every corner. Only a window at the far end lets in any real light. The rest is from dingy fluorescent lamps in the ceiling where most of the ceiling tiles are missing. The floor is stained, the walls shabby with patches and peeling paint. The chairs wherein many of the clients are now seated, dumpy as the overstuffing fell out years ago. Papers, filing cabinets, and a phone create a makeshift office in the corner. Yet there is still a brightness in the room. It's not from the light, it's not the reflection from the large floor-to-ceiling mirror in the corner. It comes from the humble complacency written on the faces of those in the circle and those who are serving them. A large therapist, Rita, steps into the circle. She's like an Italian Aunt Jemima, her lips sticky as she smacks sharp Italian on her patients. "Okay, you know the routine. Don't make me sit in your lap to get it out. Come on, who's first?" Moses, the black kid with the body cast, speaks out boldly. I scratched my butt." There's chuckles and shock. Moses is proud. Rita stares. "And how did you manage that in a body cast, young man?" Moses. I sat on my cat and she went crazy." Moses lets out a deep laugh. Everyone is humored. Rita glares. Becky holds back a laugh. Harry chimes in, raising what's left of his amputated arm. "Yeah, I'm going to try that. You know how many times I've reached around to scratch, only to find there was nothing to scratch with?" More laughs. Rita. All right. That's enough. Now, who did something they hadn't done before? And butt scratching doesn't count." The stories began to flow, one after another, as everyone listens intently in the following dialogue. Billy. "I started playing the guitar again." Harry. "I wrote a letter." Left-handed, of course. Moses. "I had a visit from the man that ran me over. We had a good talk, and I told him I was sorry I'd run out in front of his car. Sure was a nice car before he hit me." Moses grins, slightly snickering from the others. Several other clients in the group speak up. Client number one is a blind woman, 58. "I cooked an entire meal for my husband and cleaned up afterwards. He said it was the best supper he had ever had." Client number two, 25, with bruises on her face. I drove again, just around the block, but I did it." Jessica. "I baked cookies for my brother." This gets a round of applause. Jessica is pleased with herself, yet embarrassed. Becky hugs her from behind. "You go, girl." Jessica squeals. It has to become a signature of her excitement. There's a slight hesitation before Kit, the burned mother, raises her hand. Rita says, "Kit, what did you do that was new this week?" Cole turns his whole head to watch. Kit speaks through deformed lips, but surprisingly, her words are eloquent and clear. Yesterday, I went fishing. The room erupts in laughter and conversation. Rita, listen, everyone listen. Fishing? Becca, Kit's daughter, now kneeling at her side, speaks up. It's true. Grandpa took us fishing and Mama came with us. David, Kit's son, lights the room with enthusiasm. She even caught a fish. This is too much. The room again erupts in laughter and shouts of victory. Then the door opens and Addie enters. Dropping her coat, she steps to the edge of the circle. What's all the excitement? Jessica, Kit caught a fish. Addie, fish? How? Moses, she went fishing. How else? Addie, that's wonderful. Addie hugs Kit. Sorry I'm late. Rita, Mr. Smith, it's your turn. Everyone turns to Cole. The room grows hushed. Cole swallows hard. He makes eye contact with everyone in the room. Jessica, you have to say something. Kit, it's his first time. Billy, maybe he can't do anything. Nothing. Cole looks away. A pause, and Addie adds, in time. I'm sure Mr. Smith will master all his talents. Harry, and habits. The room grows animated once again. Rita, everyone to your stations. You know where you're supposed to be. Let's go. No excuses. Come on. The group breaks. Everyone heads to a therapy, machine, table, or other setting. But our attention is on Cole, who sits a long moment alone. Becky appears in front of Cole again and is seated next to him, a clipboard in hand. It seems as though we're missing some of your information, so I just need to ask you a few more questions. What is your address? Cole turns his head and stares at Becky. She waits. Cole moves his hands to a leather bag in his lap. Unzipping it, he pulls out a card. With all the strength he can muster, he lays it on the table. Becky reviews it. This is good. It looks like it has everything I need. Who's caring for you at home? Cole looks away. You do have someone caring for you. No answer. Becky continues. How did you get here? I need to know who to contact in an emergency. Cole is silent. Becky moves on. Well, just one more step and you're an official client. Without warning, Becky lifts a Polaroid camera from her side and snaps a picture. The flash is blinding. Cole reacts violently, shouting, no picture, no picture. This draws a great deal of attention. Addie, noticing the problem, approaches Becky and Cole. I just took his picture. It's policy. All clients get their pictures taken. Addie defends Becky. We use them to encourage your success. It's really harmless. Cole. No picture. No picture. Addie. All right. Becky, give me the picture. Becky reluctantly hands over the picture. Addie continues. Thank you. I'll finish here. Addie is seated. Her motions are precise. Her words, too. She slides the picture across the table to Cole. No picture. The picture remains face down on the table. Cole tries to ignore Addie's stare as she is seated. I'm Addie. Addie Gold. Adding lightly. I'm not Jewish, just adopted to one. Cole, very uncomfortable, turns away even more. I'm the owner of Loveworks. That's what we call it anyhow. It's not an official title. We all sat around brainstorming and that's what we ended up with. Jessica's working on a sign so we can put at least something up out front. We note Jessica working diligently on her sign at a table across the room. Addie hasn't blinked or taken her eyes off Cole. She is direct and bold. When I read your registration request, I was intrigued. Many of your disabilities are ones that we've had great success overcoming. I had Rita move you to the top of my waiting list. I was also intrigued that you were able to pay 6 months of therapy up front. I'm not generally greedy, but an offer like that, one has to take. And God knows this place needs a few upgrades. I thank you for that. Cole takes in the surroundings to avoid making eye contact as Addie continues. So that's as much as I know about you, and that's all I'm going to tell you about me, for now. Addie watches as a small stream of saliva escapes Cole's mouth and drips onto his coat. Cole uses his sleeve to clumsily wipe his lip. Don't stare. Is that what you think I'm doing? Cole. That's the definition when someone stares at another person. Yes. Natty. You can't use the word staring in the definition of staring. Cole turns. He stares back. Addie studies his face. Why are you here, Mr. Smith? Turning away, arrogantly, flippant.
To improve my etiquette.
Addie. Well, that shouldn't be hard as long as you don't eat or talk. Adding without hesitation. I'm really interested to know. You see, most of my clients come to me begging to be whole again. They actually believe that I have the power to make them what they once were before. They believe it so much that their will takes over, and they actually do become better than what they were before. It's the reason for my picture. So I ask you again, Mr. Smith, why are you here? When he's ready to answer and turns his head, Addie has risen and stepped away. Cole watches as she crosses the room and interacts with Jessica. His eyes are drawn to the picture on the table. Reaching for it, he pulls it into his lap. Dropping his head, he stares at it. Interior Auditorium Ballet Company, late afternoon. Michael pulls his jacket on while standing back, staring at the backdrop before him. He nibbles on an apple. Joey appears on stage.
Michael, you think I could get a lift downtown?
Michael. Sure, you can carry that stuff to my car. Joey scoops up a box of paint supplies from the floor and follows Michael across the stage.
Joey, it's looking good. You like painting?
That's what I do. You like dancing?
Joey, it's what I do.
The two exit the backstage door. Interior therapy clinic, same time. It's like a Sunday school event as everyone gets picked up by a loved one or a significant other. Kit's husband is greeted with glee by the children. He hugs Kit as they exit the clinic. Becky calls after.
I don't like fish, but if you could catch a man, it would be great.
There's a lot of laughing. Billy's girlfriend gives him a kiss as he leans on her and exits. Billy's girl.
Good night.
Moses gets wheeled out by his mother in his wheelchair. His father stays behind a moment.
Moses. Good night, Rita.
Thanks, Addie.
Addie, good night, Moses. You're doing real fine. That cast will be off before you know it. Moses' father steps in front of Addie.
Miss Gold, I don't have a check for you today. I'm real sorry, but things have been tight. Could I pay you double on the first?
Addie, you're good for it.
I'm not worried, so don't you be either.
Moses' father. Thank you, Miss Gold. You're good to Moses, and we appreciate it. Never expected something like this to happen to our Moses. Well, he's going to be fine, and once that cast comes off, he'll be better than before, Addie stated.
Moses' father. I hope you're right. Thank you. Good night.
Michael and Joey enter. Jessica screams with glee, crosses the room, and leaps into Michael's arms.
Michael!
Michael, whoa, careful. It's not like you've never seen me. I dropped you off this morning, remember? Cole stares intently from the back of the room at the warm reception. Addie and Michael kiss. Joey puckers up as though he might get another kiss from Addie.
Michael, no, one kiss. That was all you get.
Addie, sorry. As Addie puts on her coat, Rita draws her attention to Cole at the opposite end of the room, the only client left.
Addie continued,
who brought him this morning?
Rita, he was outside the door when I arrived today, like a lost puppy.
Addie, does anyone know where he lives? Becky pulls his file off a nearby table and hands Addie the contact card. Addie reads, Rockefeller Plaza? This gets a rise of admiration.
Addie, not the poor side of things.
Joey, that's where I live.
Everyone looks to Joey.
No, really, I live with my aunt. She's letting me stay there till I can get a place of my own.
Addie approaches Cole with Michael and Joey tagging behind.
Addie, Mr. Smith, do you have anyone coming for you?
Cole stares at Michael intently. Addie notices.
Do you know one another?
Cole looks away.
Michael, no.
Introducing Michael Moon. Michael extends his hand. Cole raises his and the two shake. And shake.
When they stop shaking, their hands are still locked together.
Cole, I can't let go.
Michael gently pries his hand loose from Cole's fingers.
Quite a grip, Mr. Smith, is it?
Cole avoids eye contact.
Addie, Mr. Smith, this is Joey.
Joey, hey.
Addie, Joey lives in the Rockefeller Plaza. I'd sleep better knowing you got there safely. I hate to misplace a client on his first day.
The group waits for a reply.
Interior Cole's apartment. Night. The room is dark. A moment's pause and the door opens as Joey steps into the room. Pulling the keys from the door, he holds them out to Cole. Cole does not take them, so Joey timidly sets them into his lap. Moving back into the hallway, Joey pushes Cole into the room.
Let me find a light for you.
No.
Joey looks inside.
Nice place.
In the dark. Must be killer in the light. There's no response.
Okay, well listen, I'm just down on the third floor. If you ever need anything, number 360.
Simulating a full circle with his head.
Yeah, well, anything at all, you let me know.
Good night, Mr. Smith.
Joey exits and pulls the door shut behind him. There is a deafening stillness in the blackness where we can barely make out Cole's figure. A moment's pause and he moves his chair forward. We hear more than we see. A table is bumped, then a wall, then a door. As we turn in the room, we can see the lights of New York spanning for miles from this penthouse view. A few more moments of darkness and a light goes on in the kitchen. As Cole maneuvers his chair to the kitchen table, where a lone box sits. Cole stares at the cigar-like music box a long while. Moving his hands to the table, then the box, he slowly opens its lid. The inside of the small brown chest is lined with blue velvet. Earrings and a necklace of glass stone are neatly laid out on the base. But what seems to catch our attention most is the glass stone that mostly resembles an icicle. Cole stares at it a long while as the melody fills our senses. We recognize the narrator's voice and the familiar words from the opening scene. They stared at one another, the ballerina and the soldier, for he was dying. Flashback. Interior upscale restaurant 6 months earlier, night. Cole sits across from Cindy, his fiancée, in this elegant restaurant. Cole listens intently as though he really did care what she was saying. Cindy continues the fairy tale, and it is now that we recognize her voice as that of the narrator earlier. Cindy, he asked her for a drink, but she had none. But she thought a moment, and reaching forth, she broke an icicle from a nearby tree. Cole watches her as from her napkin she reveals the glass stone in the shape of an icicle. Cindy continues, pressing the icicle to the soldier's lips, he drank from its cool moisture. Simulating the scene, she presses the icicle to her own lips. Cole sighs. Embarrassed, he looks to the table surrounding to see who may be watching. His face is tight, serious. Cindy leans forward, resting her elbows on the table, cupping her cheeks into her hand. She whispers, "The ballerina cried for the soldier and his sorrow. Then, giving her the only thing he had left to give, he passed away." The two stare at one another a long moment.
Cole, an icicle? A stone one at that. It's what I've always wanted.
Reaching into his own lap, Cole produces the cigar box and slides it over to Cindy. Her eyes sparkle. She grins. Gently opening its lid, she reveals the gem necklace. A woman and a man at a nearby table smile affectionately. Cole rises. He is a master of etiquette and finesse. Stepping behind Cindy, he takes the necklace and fits it around her neck as she bows her head gracefully. Now many couples watch the loving exchange. Once fastened, he lowers his head next to hers.
"Do you like it?"
Cindy, "I love it." They kiss. Cole steps back to his seat. A distinguished man nearby offers,
"Well done, Cole."
Cole is seated.
"Could the highwayman have done better?"
Sydney thinks. She wants to answer and is about to when Cole interjects.
"He wasn't as rich as I am. What could he possibly have given his lover of equal or greater value?"
Cole raises his glass. "To the highwayman, may he forever be free of his thirst."
Cole gulps his wine. Cindy reflects. Flash forward. Interior Cole's apartment, night. Cole sits, staring at the music box. Exterior forest, night. Snow falls heavily now. The moonlight is only a flicker. We move close to the dead soldier covered by the panther skin. Closer, until we suddenly notice something we had not noticed before. The ballerina's slippers rest gently at his side, their delicate silkiness beaded with snowflakes. Happy Valentine's Day. We'll be here all week as we continue our film series story, Love Works. Until that time, may God richly bless you. Good night.